Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
In this episode of the podcast, we're going to be talking about BMW M, the M division. There's so much to get stuck into there. And then we're also going to look at a couple of recent Drive Nation posts. But before we get stuck into it, I just want to remind all of you listening, and I'll be very brief, I promise, that Drive Nation is now on Patreon. You can find us at patreon.com/Drive Nation. And for those who don't know, Patreon is a platform that allows our followers to financially support us each month to help make DN bigger and better, bring in other voices. And everyone who does support us on Patreon, they get exclusive written content each week, and just a huge thank you to everybody so far who has contributed. We've been really touched, really blown away actually, and it is going to make a huge difference. So if you want to support us, please do go to patreon.com/drivenation. Andrew, anything to add?
Well, only to echo what you were saying about how grateful we are, as I'm sure lots of people who listen to the podcast and follow us on Instagram. I mean, DN is not something that Dan and I are doing to make us rich. It's something that we've just loved doing. And we've, you know, to date, we've been almost 2 years at it and we've yet to take a single penny out of the business. And, you know, this isn't going to go to, you know, helping us get drunk when we can go back to the pub. It's money we need to be able to continue, because as you may also know, we do have plans to expand and do other things with DN, and we can't do any of it without a bit of investment. And we do get some through sponsored posts, and that's getting better too. But Patreon is such a great way for you guys to help us. And we will every week post new long form content, some of which is already up there at the moment. So yeah, firstly, thanks so much. And secondly, if you haven't sponsored us, if you could consider it, you know, a few quid, you know, 1 quid, 10 quid, whatever you like, per month would just mean the world to us. So yeah, anyway, there you go. End of promo.
I'll bolt on one very quick comment to add there. Andrew's too modest to say this, so I'll say it. The first bit of patron only content that we published was Andrew's story about meeting Ayrton Senna, and it's a brilliant tale. I loved reading it. Even if you only sign up now on Patreon, you'll be able to read that piece. So yeah, please do go and check it out. Patreon.com/Drive Nation. Enough, we're done. Let's talk about BMW M.
Yay!
It's a good topic, this one. I'm looking forward to getting stuck in.
It's a good topic because it's not all good, is it?
Oh, well, there you go. Exactly right.
It's not one of those things where, you know, as we probably will, where we do one where, you know, we talk about, I don't know, GT3s or something like that. It's, you know, you're going to struggle to, you know, get your teeth into a subject like that, because it's all going to sound like us sort of worshipping at the altar of Andreas Preuninger. But I think BMW M, it's a great subject because, you know, there's lots of fantastic stuff that they've done and actually are still doing. And then between those poles, there's how can we put this, some perhaps not so brilliant stuff.
From M1 to the X6M.
Oh,
The highs and the lows. Okay. Well, so BMW M is probably the most famous of the in the official tuning divisions. You think of Mercedes AMG, Audi Quattro / Sport / RS. I think BMW M is the one that still has the most cachet. M for motorsport, because it was originally a racing division, founded in 1972. And the first road car was, very appropriately enough, the M1. They must have thought about that one for minutes. That arrived in 1978. A gorgeous Giugiaro design, sort of angular mid-engine supercar shape. Straight six engine that was later used by the E28 M5. Individual throttle bodies, 3.5 litres, 276 brake horsepower. I've never driven one. I know someone who has. Andrew, you've driven an M1, but have you driven more than one M1?
No, I haven't.
Just
no,
one?
I'm afraid just the one of them, which is BMW GB own one. And I drove that. And again, another one of the astonishing privileges of this job. I can't even remember why. What excuse I cooked up, but they just came and dropped it off for a few days. and so I just had an M1 parked outside my house. This was a while back. But yes, I mean, the funny thing about the M1 is I always kind of look at it as a sort, almost like a sort of breed apart, because, you know, it's the only mid-engine two-seat supercar that they've done. It doesn't really, you know, engine aside, it doesn't really inform the rest of the M debate, but it was an absolutely superb car. I mean, they were quite cheap for a while because they didn't have the right badge on them, because they didn't have a huge amount of power, they didn't have some stonking V12 in them, and I think that people were just a little bit sniffy about them. But I think in recent years, I think big people are beginning to understand that they're very rare and very special things. And obviously, they've got the competition history, which so many other cars like that don't. And to drive, it's all about, you know, that thing about it's not how fast you go, but how you go fast.
Yeah.
You know, if a Martian fell to Earth and said, well, what does that mean? You just stick them in an M1, because it's not the quickest thing out there, but it's just so beautiful. It's so delicate. It sounds wonderful. I mean, the interior is rubbish, and, you know, the car has other flaws. But, you know, put that car on a decent road, and because of its dimensions, because it was actually a pretty well-developed car, and that beautiful engine, it's just heaven on wheels.
I've called it a supercar, you've called it a supercar, but is it one?
That's an entire podcast on that question, isn't it? Yeah, of course it is. Of course it is. Why? Okay, so why? I mean, why wouldn't it be? I mean, supercars.
Power.
Well, yeah, but people sort of talk about the the Mercedes 300 SL 1954 being the first supercar. Well, that had, what did it have? 220 horsepower. So, you know, a lot less even than the M1. You know, if Lamborghini were honest with their power outputs at the time, you know, the Miura.
What are you suggesting?
What I'm suggesting is that half a century ago, clearly not now, because there are things like regulations, but I think certain Italian manufacturers were perhaps a little bit, sunny in their estimates of those things. But, you know, even that, you know, even a Miura, a stock standard P400 Miura, probably wouldn't have had, honestly, much more power than the M1 had. And clearly that 276 horsepower was absolutely on the button. So, yeah, I could absolutely supercar, no question at all to me.
So we're going to talk about BMW M and lots of different road cars individually, not all of them. But I just want to leap right ahead to the present day, just for a moment, because the M1 is the only sort of standalone model that BMW M has produced. And nowadays we see Audi Sport building the R8 supercar, we see AMG with the GT, and of course the AMG 1, that stunning hypercar that we hope is still happening.
Yeah.
But there's never been another standalone BMW M supercar.
No, but there should have been. Why didn't they make an MI8 or an I8M, you know?
Yes.
I mean, I can remember having this conversation with them, and they were saying, oh, no, M's one thing and I's another, and never the twain shall meet. And I just never got it. Why not?
I've said exactly the same thing before in a video. I thought there was such potential in that I8 to be a bit grippier, a bit tauter, a bit faster. It,
yeah.
You know, it could have been lovely.
You've got all the, you know, you've got all the raw ingredients there. You know, you've got a carbon tub sitting there. It's, you know, it was, you know, for a plug-in hybrid, it was unbelievably light. Mid-engine car, very, very good chassis. Okay, fine, it was in that particular tune, it was set up for touring, but you could quite easily tweak that and make it, you know, a properly responsive. And, you know, and they just didn't do it because... You know, I think the people who did I and the people who do it, maybe they just don't talk to each other. I don't know. But I mean, I can remember having literally going to, I was interviewing someone about, it might have been an i3 or something, but and just saying, oh, just while you're here and seeing as you're from BMW, just run this past me. And there's one, we couldn't.
Yeah.
Because we're I and they're M, and then that's it.
I asked the same question of one of the very senior BMW M execs. And I said, come on, Mercedes are doing this, Audi are doing this. Why not you? And he just said, well, the M4 GTS, which was new at the time, that is a supercar if you look at the engineering.
For goodness sake.
No, it's not. Come
no,
on.
No, it's not. No, it's not.
Okay. All right. Well, that's today. Let's jump back to the late 1970s because I want to ask you what you remember or what you've become aware of since of the M1 Pro Car series because, wow.
Yeah, Pro Car. I mean, it's a lovely idea, isn't it? I mean, probably the greatest one make race series that there's ever been. And you know, I think they just sort of thought that. I mean, let's not be shy about this. The reason they did it is they couldn't sell the M1, and you know, and they had lots and lots of cars with nowhere to go, and they thought that at least it would get them some publicity. You know, I think they probably thought that all these Formula One drivers would just go around, you know, going after you, Claude, and they're not to be too much problem. And you put all these F1 guys in these cars. People who don't know, a Pro Car ran, I think, for two series as a support race for Formula One, and they just put all the same drivers in near identical cars, and it was just bloody carnage. But what fun to watch! I mean, just really, really good fun. And they all had their names on the side of the car, so you could see who was in them. And yeah, I mean, I was probably sort of 14, 15 when they were doing it, so I kind of have hazy recollections of it. But I've certainly watched a lot of it on YouTube since.
Yeah, it's such a cool idea. And again, one of those things that you absolutely could not imagine happening now. I mean, just no chance. So it did run for 2 years, 79 and 80, but only in 79 was it a full F1 support series. And it was for F1 drivers with, you know, top line racers coming in from other categories as well. Let me read you some of the names from the first season. And just imagine if we had something comparable today. Mario Andretti, Emerson Fittipaldi, James Hunt, Alan Jones, Jacques Lafitte, Niki Lauda, Nelson Piquet, Didier Pironi, Clay Regazzoni, John Watson, Tiffany Dale.
Way! Go, Tiff. Can you imagine a one-mate race series? Imagine if they all just bowled up and did a Carrera Cup round. I mean, it would just be brilliant, wouldn't it? Oh, God, if anybody's out there listening to this who knows anybody who may be in a position to make this happen, just please do. I mean, I know you never could, but it would just be brilliant, wouldn't it? I mean, and you could almost put them in anything because just to, you know, the level playing field.
Yes.
You never really know how good a driver is. I mean, clearly Lewis is amazing, but he's also in an absolutely amazing car. And I just love it when those sorts of things, I mean, as you say, they never happen these days, but just to be able to see who really has got it. Yeah, it'd be so good, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, I think we'll have to keep dreaming. It would be an iRacing thing now, wouldn't it? That would be today's comparable sort of series.
Yeah.
God, I feel a bit deflated after that.
Wake me up when you're done.
Okay. All right, well, we're getting a bit distracted with M1 Pro Car stuff because really we're supposed to be talking about road cars. So after the M1, let's get stuck into some of the highlights. People always go on about the E30 M3. Is that really the car? What are your thoughts? I've driven one briefly. Does it actually stack up to that legend?
Were you slightly disappointed? Or was it fantastic?
Yeah, slightly disappointed. I mean, but you can only be disappointed, can't you, with that kind of reputation?
I think that's the thing. So, I do think it is the car, and for a couple of reasons. Firstly, and for me, probably most importantly, is it's authentic. It is a proper homologation special, and everything about it, literally from the gear pattern with a dog leg first, to the body shell, the suspension, the engine. I mean, it was all done for racing reasons. And, you know, I've written about homologation specials on DN, and I do just think that they are different. I think because they're conceived for a different reason, and I think that they come with an authenticity and with a credibility that cars, you know, however fast they are, however much fun they are to drive, which are purely conceived for road use, just don't have. So I think it is, for that reason, I think it is the one. But I also think it is the one because, to me, it best expresses the essence of what I want an M car to be, which is not hugely fast or anything like that, but just a car that is focused on the provision of pure driving pleasure, which actually means, most importantly, is it a car that should be light and simple. And I don't think it's a coincidence that during the course of this conversation, when we talk about the M cars that we like most and indeed the M cars that we like least, lightness and simplicity will play a very big role in that, because I think, you know, for all cars, all enthusiast driving machines, but for M cars in particular, that's what it's all about. And, you know, and you know, M1 aside, the M3 was not just the first of the proper M cars to go down that line, but it was probably the lightest and the simplest of the lot.
And also, I think certainly until relatively recently, a fundamental BMW M car trait was a stunning high revving engine.
Yeah, no, it absolutely was. I mean, that four-cylinder engine, if you've ever seen the sort of Group A racing versions of them, I mean, that engine was safe to way past 9,000 revs, and it was and that became the sort of characteristic, didn't it, with the fours and with the sixes, and then up to, which I'm sure we'll get onto, the sort of crazy V10s and that sort of thing. M's were, yeah, they weren't all about the engines, but, you know, that was a critical component of them. One really good reason. I mean, that engine that was in the M1, which then went on to be in the E28 and E34 M5s and in the M635 CSI, was one of my favourite cars of all time. I mean, what an engine. Just the most beautiful sounding, incredible torque delivery, just everything you want an M car, you know, the way it would just sort of build and build and really come on the cam. And, you know, you get out of that and you just think six cylinders are enough. You just don't need any more than that. It was just brilliant, that motor.
Yeah. And as we all switch to turbocharging, it's become increasingly difficult for such an engine to stand out, hasn't it?
Yeah, but look at an M2 comp, actually. You know, I think that is BMW, you know, at its best, because, you know, you drive an M2 comp, it doesn't feel turbocharged, does it? Not like a, you know, a 911 Turbo S feels turbocharged, doesn't it? You wait a bit and then kaboom. And I think that BMW over time has actually done better than almost anybody at making turbocharged cars like that feel not turbocharged. So fair play to them for that.
We'll get back onto the M2 comp soon enough, because I've got a bit to say about that. And actually, on the E30, so E30 road car, yeah, drove it, lovely thing, but it didn't blow me away. But the one that did blow me away was a ProDrive built E30 M3 rally car.
Ooh.
Which I drove at Myra a few years ago, and it was just the most spectacular thing. It was phenomenal to drive, but that engine. So what is it? Is it a 2.5 liter?
2.3 and 2.5. So the Evo twos. So they did it in a 200 horsepower 2.3, then a 215 horsepower 2.3, and then they went to the 2.5, which is in the sort of the last of them with the Evo twos with the big wings on them.
That's right. And so the motorsport version, clearly it's a grenade, that thing, and it revved to 9. I think it made 300 horsepower or something.
Wow.
And it was stunning. And I remember, I think the exhaust, it wasn't quite side exit, but maybe it sort of angled off to one corner. And I remember watching it drive past me at full tilt, and it was a good quarter of a mile away. And I didn't so much hear the noise as feel it. It just hit my chest.
Yeah.
And it was that made me realise. You said six cylinders are enough.
Four cylinders are enough.
Exactly. I just thought, wow. You sort of grow up thinking four cylinders are a bit weedy, but
yeah.
Oh, not after that.
Yeah, mega thing.
Okay, so let's now talk about some of the M5s. The first one was the E28 and then into the E34. What are your memories of those cars? I mean, is it true that the first one is the sweetest one?
Certainly one of. If you talk to Chris Harris, who has an E28 and an E34, I think he'll tell you that the E28 is the one.
He adores his.
Again, it's the simplest, it's the lightest, and you know, it's got that engine, and it's a long time since I've driven an E28 M5. I was always an E34 fan, because to me they had, I mean, I just love the usability, because they were so comfortable and quiet, and it's just the sort of, you know, it was just a wonderful daily driver. And you know, I'm sort of old enough that you know, these cars were around brand new when I was doing the job I'm doing now, and I can just remember it was always a great day when one of those turned up in the car park. And I can remember things like cars I really liked, like the what was it, the Mercedes, the 500, the E500, when Porsche did that, engineered that V8 W124, and that was a great car. And then the Lotus Carlton came along, which was a much quicker car than an E34 M5, but I just always preferred the E34. It was just more delicate. It just spoke to me more about what I want a car like that to be. They just handled better. They felt more special. And of course, they always had that engine on.
And the one that followed that then, the first of the V8s,
E39. Yeah, that was the kind of ultimate sideways machine. I mean, I think Autocar used to do this thing called the Sideways Challenge, where we'd go to a skid pan somewhere, usually at Chobham, and we'd invite all sorts of people. Lewis Hamilton being one of them, actually, once, when he was a very young lad, just to get in a car and go sideways around this big circle, which I think we usually had a water bowser there and would wet it just to save the cars and the tyres a bit. And of all the cars that we went and did that in, the E39 M5 was by far my favourite. It was just one of those cars, you could just get it to the most ridiculous angles and hold it there forever. And you could be really, could be really accurate with it. And I just felt that people had really, really thought hard about that. And just the simple business of making a car fun to drive. And yet at the same time, here was this, you know, beautifully equipped, large five-seat family saloon. Just, yeah, brilliant car.
What do you make of the E60 M5, the one that followed that with that outrageous, almost a racing engine, that V10?
Yeah.
They were so highly spec'd, those engines, but the car as a whole. And you look at them now and they cost about £9 to buy, but £1 million.
Exactly. We know why they're so cheap to buy. We never had that perspective because they never blew up on us. I didn't like the gearbox in them. And to me, that substantially spoiled the car. And also, you know, if you think about it sort of objectively, they had, you know, these were 5-litre engines with, I think they had 510 horsepower. So you're talking about over 100 horsepower per litre. And that was fine, but it also meant, you know, I think they revved to 8 and a bit or something, and they were just a bit peaky. And in a car like that, whose first job, I'm afraid, is to be a daily driver, I felt that they had perhaps gone a bit too far, can I say that? In a way that the E34 and E39 didn't. That said, I can remember having some absolutely ridiculous drives, and particularly actually in the E61, the estate. You remember that?
Yeah.
The M5 Touring. And just having more fun in an estate car than I don't think I've ever had. You know, even the best of the E63 AMG estates, I don't think in terms of the sort of disparity between, you know, the idea of a 5-door estate car capable of carrying, you know, everything from your Labradors to your Holday, and then the driving experience on offer. I don't think that anything ever got near the E61 M5, certainly not as a standard production car, and I don't think that anything has since.
I've never driven an E60 M5. I've driven the M6 version, but I have just remembered that I've been driven in one of those M5s by Nigel Mansell.
Ha! You've just remembered that.
I've just remembered.
Not the sort of thing you think you'd forget, but
it's pitiful, isn't it?
Tell me.
So it was on the road. I think his place is either in Dorset or Devon. It's down there somewhere. And it was actually, I must have been 20 years old before I'd got my first job in this industry. I was doing a one-off job for Motorsport News, I think. And part of it involved going down to Mansell's karting track and then him driving us off somewhere else. So there he was driving me in this outrageous car and I couldn't quite believe it was happening. And I was nattering away to him about Lewis Hamilton, who was very new on the F1 scene back then. So this must have been 07 perhaps. And he said, watch this, effectively. And he changed down two or three gears, put his foot down, and the car roared away, engine howling. And I just thought it was the coolest thing. And I said to him, yeah, but does this feel really slow to you? And he said, yeah, it's a bit sluggish. It would be, I suppose.
Of course it would be. Of course it would be.
When you've qualified almost 1,500 horsepower Formula 1 cars, I suppose everything is.
Yeah. I mean, but so did he drive fast most of the time? Or was he just... Because, I mean, sometimes I've been with F1 drivers on the road and they're just not interested. They just they just kind of like tootle along and, just don't want to go fast.
He did. He did more or less tootle along, yeah. I mean, he gave it a bit of tap, but...
Yeah.
Sadly, it wasn't one of those, you know, live demonstrations of raw driving talent, but there we go. Cool thing nonetheless. All right. Okay. Let's switch back to the M3s. Because we've spoken a bit about the E30, but we need to sort of follow that lineage a little bit because E36, I mean, some people are now sort of revising their view on that car and saying, actually, it was a great thing. But in our notes, you say then the disappointment of the E36 M3.
Yeah, and it was. It was, you know, and this is something I remember very well. I remember going on the lawn. I remember sitting down with its chief engineer at dinner that night and going,
no.
I must have had a few, actually, because I was, you know, I was fairly frank with them. And I said, what you've done is you've made a really good car. It's just not an M car. And I remember saying to him, why didn't you call it a 330 CSI? Because that's what you've made. because, you know, and you have to remember the context. The context is we just all got out of E30s, you know, racing cars for the road and got into this quiet and comfortable thing with this sort of slightly woolly steering. And it didn't have the handling balance. And, you know, the engine was lovely, but it was heavier. It was more ponderous. It just didn't feel, you know, I had back then a very specific idea of what an M car was, and that wasn't it.
And did they improve it over the years with the Evo and GT?
Yeah, they did. Yeah, I mean, the second generation one was a lot better. But I think, frankly, the car, you've only got to go and drive an E46 M3 to know that BMW did come to realise that they needed to liven things up a bit. And as you know, as I'm sure everybody who's driven one who's listening to this would agree, E46 is just one of the greatest of all M cars.
I mean, that's right. You look at that whole package, and I think it's lighter than 1400. Maybe it's about 1400 kilograms. It's got that gorgeous 3.2-litre normally aspirated straight six.
Yeah. About 343 horsepower. Yeah.
You can and should have the manual gearbox. And it looks really pretty even now. Just enough muscle, but not overly aggressive like so many of today's performance cars. It's the right size. That's sort of the one, isn't it? That's when everything came together. It had enough technology that it was safe and reliable and all the rest of it, but still fast and light.
Do you know what, Dan? I think you're absolutely right. And today, and this, I can't see this lasting forever, you know, they're still quite affordable and they are, to me, yeah, I mean, okay, let's put it this way. To me, that is where the sort of the natural progression from the E30 sort of that's the furthest it got, and that's the best that it was. I haven't driven an E46 M3 for a long time. I mean, maybe it's one of those cars you get back in it and you wonder what all the fuss was like, but I really don't think so. I can remember once I drove one to Le Mans, and you do what you usually do is you get there quite quickly because you're always late, and then you listen to you watch the race, and I can just remember going home, and usually when you're going home, you're so tired and you're late for work, and I can remember just loving this drive and keeping off all the motorways and finally getting back to London at God knows what time in the morning and getting out of, and not wanting to get out of it. It was just such a great car, and just so beautifully judged. It had an amazing diff in it, I remember, and it was had such good balance and a wonderful engine. And yeah, God, what's not to like?
God, every time I think too hard about these cars, I realise that I need to get on Auto Trade and try and buy one.
It's
dangerous, really. Okay, let's have a think about the M3 CSL, still E46.
Ooh.
It's such an interesting car. It had those very early generation cup tyres that were dicey in the wet but super grippy in the dry. When you talk to owners, and of course they're partisan, aren't they? They defend that single clutch flappy paddle gearbox all the way, and they say, yeah, but it's part of the driving experience, and if you lift
it is part of the driving experience because you don't have a choice. But that's the only reason. It's not a good part of the driving experience. I know how sensitive people are about those cars, but if I'm honest with you, given how much they cost and given that gearbox, I never thought they were worth it. And I know that to some people listening to this, it'll be an absolutely sacrilegious thing to say. But I have driven, I think, all of them, all the M3s, that is. I can remember, when would it have been, chasing someone, I was in one, and chasing someone in a Mark 1 Focus RS. And then we swapped. In fact, I think it was Harris. And then he chased me, and we're a different car. And I just remember having more fun in the Ford. Is that a terrible thing to say? Probably
is. Not if it's true.
Well, it is. I mean, I just enjoyed it more. And you know, I can only report as I find. So, you know, I love that generation of car, but the CSL for me was. I mean, I do get. I mean, it made an amazing noise, and it was fast, and it looked great, and I understand it's a very cool car for all those sorts of reasons. But for the money and for the experience that it offered, I just thought the standard car was better.
So that that era of M3, the E46 M3 engine, is called the S54. And the last time I drove a car with an S54, it wasn't a BMW. It was almost an Aston Martin, but not quite. Do you know where this is going? It was one of the stunt cars, the purpose-built stunt cars.
Oh, I know where you're going. Yeah.
For the Bond film, No Time to Die. And for the film, Aston Martin built 8, I think it was, purpose-built stunt cars based around even a custom chassis. It's an extraordinary thing. And they're carbon-bodied with basically millimetrically perfect DB5 bodywork. So you look at them from the outside and they just look like DB5s. But they've got this custom chassis underneath. They've got fully independent double wishbone suspension all round, all motorsport spec, Ohlins dampers. They're on these sort of Goodwood style racing tyres, you know, more modern construction, but they look like old cross plies.
Yeah.
And it weighs 1,000 kilograms, and it's got that S54 motor in it. So just over, about 340 horsepower with a 6-speed manual gearbox. And oh my word, it's one of the most amazing machines that I've ever driven, that car. But the engine is right at the heart of it, breathing through more or less an open pipe. It was utterly sensational. I've come to realise now, having driven, I think I wrote about this for DN fairly recently, having also driven an earlier Bond stunt car, the Jaguar CX-75, that there were a handful of them built specifically for doing the jumps and for being rattled down steps and all the skids and all that stuff. Williams Advanced Engineering built a handful of CX-75s, or at least, you know, space frame cars dressed up to look like CX-75s. And I drove one in Mexico. It was bizarre. It's because the North American or the premiere for the Americas of that film was in Mexico, and having driven both that car and the DB5, I just think that stunt cars are the best things ever.
I don't think I've ever driven one of any sort.
Oh, you have to try and have a go in this Aston, because these cars are built to be really playful and controllable. Yeah. You know, they have to slide around. They have to be tough. They have to be really strong. They've got plenty of wheel travel and very plush suspension so that they can deal with poor surfaces, with being rattled down steps, jumps, all that stuff. And they don't have the sort of snappy knife-edge balance of a racing car. They take far more punishment than a road car. If I could, I'd just drive stunt cars everywhere.
It is interesting what you're saying about that DB5, though, is that, you know, you talk about, you know, you've got a car there that looks just like an Aston Martin DB5, and underneath it is the chassis and suspension of a sort of, a bespoke motorsport car. And actually, what's blowing you away almost as much as any of that is this sort of 20-year-old six-cylinder engine, you know, from an old BMW. And the fact that, you know, of all, presumably, they could have had anything they wanted, and they just thought, yep, that'll do, that's what we need. It does, to me, speak volumes about just how good that motor was all those years ago.
Yeah, and I think maybe only now we're all beginning to realise it, aren't we? Question then, is it overall, all things considered, a better engine than the 4-litre V8 that followed?
Definitely.
The next
M3? Definitely. Yes. Better engine for an M car.
Car overall?
Yeah, I mean, yes, okay, that certainly. I mean, I think you can argue the toss for the V8. It's a great engine. It's it was obviously based on the V10. I'm not criticizing the V8. But I always thought that, you know, those M3s with straight six engines, like the ones they have now, actually, were the right sort of engines for the car. But actually, as a car, I didn't really get on with the V8 M3. I didn't trust them. The one thing that I loved about the E46 and the E30 were that they were just so lovely on the limit, totally confidence inspiring and everything else. And the V8, I just never got there with that. I never felt completely at home in it. And I can remember, you know, I think the year that Autocar had one there for its handling day, I think we were at Bedford that year, I think.
I'm
really having a bit of a punch up with it, really having to fight it, and it doing, you know, just, it wasn't that it would do, it would just kind of like throw you into the middle of nowhere. It was just like you never quite knew what it was going to do. And then when it would do it, it would just be a bit nippy and twitchy, and you'd just find yourself working hard for the wrong sorts of reasons. So, yeah, no, for me, the...
And how many laps before the brakes went?
Yeah, probably not many. Don't recall that, but I do remember just fighting with it. And, you know, and sometimes, if you're kind of both on the same side and you're having a bit of a play fight, it's fun, but sometimes you're just thinking, this is what I have to do to drive this car, and it's just getting in the way. So, yeah.
Okay, I'm sort of a bit more familiar with the more recent stuff. Rather than get stuck into all of them, I want to pick out one in particular and see what you think, because even now I'm pretty uncertain about what I think of this car. It's the M4 GTS.
Yeah.
So I remember doing the launch, which was at the Grand Prix track Catalunya near Barcelona.
Yes.
And we went out there, and all the cars, so that M4 GTS could be either in road setup or track setup. And we got there, they're all in track setup, of course. It's a track only event. And they've got those amazing Cup 2 tyres. They're on the deck on really firm suspension, all the aero, all the way out, you know, splitter extended, spoiler in sort of full attack mode. And sort of inevitably, in that kind of setup on a track, it felt stunning. It felt almost like a GT4 racing car. I've also driven an M4 GTS on dry, flowing roads up in Scotland, where actually you could really feel how sweetly suspended it was. It felt so, the damping felt so lovely on a smooth road, but an undulating one. It would, you know, if you landed into a compression, it had trick dampers on it, didn't it? They would just soak it up and the car would keep gliding along. And then I drove it in the wet, and with all the systems on, maybe I did something wrong. It almost spat me off the road in a corner when I was barely on the throttle. There's actually a sort of gif of that incident happening. I had a camera running, looking through the windscreen, and the whole car just moves to the other side of the road. And I have no idea why. So even now, I'm completely in two minds about that car. I don't know if there's more to it than dry road, wet road. But I suspect you, I think I remember you saying, you don't have a great deal of fondness for it.
Oh, no, I do not. I mean, the weird thing was that, you know, if you talk to, you know, usually when cars are so sort of extreme, that, you know, journalists who, you know, who've been doing it for a bit and know how to drive, you know, there might be nuances of opinion, but you won't often get one load of journalists going, that was fabulous, and another load going, that was terrible. But that car did it. I think Evo, I think they had one up on their Car of the Year thing, and they just absolutely loved it. I might be...
I was with Evo at that time.
Okay.
And even a couple of people had it as their favourite car, and a few of us had it way down in the bottom third.
Okay, so the only time I drove one was for the autocars equivalent, which we did in Snowdonia and at Anglesey. And I can remember driving this thing around the Evo Triangle back in the days when you could use the Evo Triangle.
Yeah, but everyone, don't go there anymore. Don't go there anymore.
No, don't. Absolutely not. Yeah, verboten. But I mean, I can remember driving around that and just thinking to myself, thank God it's not raining, because, you know, if it was raining, I'd have to park the car. It was so stiff. It was on the road then. It was just one of the most disappointing cars I'd ever driven.
Wow.
Now, I've spoken to other guys who really liked it, and we wonder whether the setup on the car that we had was wrong, because what people who I, you know like and respect thought of the car, the same car with the same number plate on it that I drove, they literally, the two views do not compute, given, you know, that we're both, you know, we're all reasonably experienced at doing this sort of thing. And I, you know, and obviously the car was very adjustable in its suspension. Maybe someone had put the wrong setup on the car, but it was, okay, it wasn't undrivable in the drive, but it was unpleasant. There wasn't anything nice about driving that car quickly on a public road, and there was no point driving it slowly. You might as well have just got the bus. And then even when we got it to Anglesey and we were on a racetrack, which was absolutely... Yeah, I can remember thinking to myself, well, at least it'll be unbelievable on the track. And it wasn't. It was good. It was fine. But it wasn't sort of like go home GT3. You don't know what you're talking about. It was still kicking and skipping off the bumps a bit. And, you know, I don't remember thinking that this was any kind of revelation at all. So, yeah, it's always been an odd car, that. But, yeah, it's certainly not one of the M cars that I will I remember most fondly by any means. Probably, actually, the most disappointing one I've driven, apart from the X6M. Now, that wasn't disappointing because I didn't expect it to be good in the first place. So, the most disappointing M car I've driven. There you go, M4 GTS.
I was going to say it'll be fun to revisit it a few years from now, but I don't think anyone's going to let you drive those now.
No, but it's all right. I don't want to.
Okay.
Actually, well, no, that's not true. I would love to drive one, which has been set up by someone who absolutely knows what the settings should be, and will stand behind it and go, okay, Andrew, I don't know what it was that you drove last time. Drive this. If you don't like it, you don't like it, but this is at least how it should be. Because I've always had this nagging doubt that the car that we had wasn't right somehow, and that I've been maligning it ever since for something which wasn't actually the fault of BMWs. But until I drive a car which we know to be right, I'll never know.
Mm, yeah, get in touch. Okay, well, on to an M2 a BMW M car that I know you do like. That's the M2 Competition.
Yeah.
I agree with you. I think it's a brilliant, really fun little thing, and a big improvement over the standard M2 that came before it as well.
Well, I like that as well.
Yeah, I liked it. I did like it. But for me, I remember driving it on some very undulating roads. And there were times where you'd come up over this crest quite quickly. The front would come back down and the front tyres would meet the road, and then the rear would keep going up, and it felt as though it was going to overtake itself, do a, you know, sort of somersault or something. And for me, the Competition is much better tied down and more fun because of it.
Having
said all of this, all the press cars that I've driven were lovely things, but I've driven a customer car recently, and it didn't have a sports exhaust, and so the soundtrack and actually the engine as a whole felt very flat and very bland. And the chassis just felt a little bit sort of leaden-footed as well. It was a strange thing to experience, having so loved M2 Competitions that I'd driven before.
I have heard someone say that engine has suffered a lot for WLTP compliance.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know whether there's anything in that because I haven't driven a car, a post WLTP car, but maybe that's why it feels a bit flat these days, don't I?
Yeah, there is something in it. But by and large, I think you and I agree that the M2 Comp is one of BMW M's highlights of the last probably decade or something.
Definitely. I mean, it's best M car I've driven. Let's quick shout out for the 1M Coupe, which to me is kind of like the car that the M2 Comp is the sort of spiritual successor to. I really like the 1M Coupe. That was a cracking little car. I'd actually really, really like to have one of those. But no, the M2 Comp, I mean, it's great insofar as it's just a nicely developed car. It does all things I'm going to do, but it's also, to me, it's just more of what an M car should be. It's more of, it's got more of the sort of the E30 about it. And I just like the size. I did a group test for someone where we had an M2. I don't think it was a comp. I don't think it was because it was too long ago. And we had an Alpina B3 and we had an M4. And the M4 wasn't in it at all. And it came down to the Alpina and the M2. I can't actually remember which one I gave it to, but the kind of whether it won it or not, the moral victor was the M2 because it was just so much cheaper and provided like 90% of the experience for a fraction of the price. Those are the sorts of cars that BMW should be building, and not X6 M's.
Okay, that was well timed because I think in a moment we're going to try and declare which is the best M car of all time. But before that, do you want to have 30 seconds grumbling about the X5 and X6 M?
No.
You'd rather not.
I just don't see the point. People have tuned in to listen to this podcast, and I think I've done a lot of grumbling on this podcast anyway. So I think that anybody who knows me or anybody who knows Drive Nation or anybody who in fact knows the X6 will know that an M version of that is perhaps not the best possible use of that. Valued and vaunted badge.
Okay. I'll take on the mantle then. Actually, it's not much of a grumble. It's just a pathetic claim to fame. The X6 M, the previous one was launched several years ago at COTA, at Circuit of the Americas in Texas, the F1 track. Great circuit. And at the time, Timo Glock was one of BMW's factory drivers. Perhaps he still is, actually. And he was leading the way in an X6 M. I was following in a train of cars, but I was immediately behind Timo Glock in the X6 M. And through that amazing left-right sequence, I was right on his tail. I remember this very clearly. I was right on his tail. And then as we kind of carried on around the lap, he just sort of started edging away a little bit. And when we jumped out, it's so pathetic that I'm telling this story, but I'm committed.
Go on.
And when we jumped out, he said, "Oh, you were going well. You were close. I had to put my radio down."
Well, there you go. That's not bad. If you made a Formula One driver have to put both hands on the steering wheel, I don't think that's anything to be ashamed of at all.
Well, we know I'm not a Lewis, because if I was, I would have overtaken him.
Oh, absolutely, yes, and denied Felipe Massa a world championship.
Okay, all right, well, let's quickly try and decide once and for all which is the best M car of all time, and I'm actually going to defer to you on this one. Can we keep it short and snappy?
Yeah, E46.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right because
an M car should be a car of the people. I mean, I could easily say an M1, but they cost hundreds of thousands, these days. And one last thing before we leave M. I just think where M is going at the moment is really interesting. I drove the M8 and was very disappointed by it because it just felt to me like, an M5. For another with less space, which costs you another 50 grand. Whereas I think the current M5 is so much better than the previous M5, and I actually hope I'm quite hopeful about the direction that M is going in. So fingers crossed, but yeah, of them all, because I think M cars should be cars for everyday enthusiasts, E46. There you go,
good answer. Okay, well, let's leave all the BMW M stuff behind because I want to hear just for a few minutes about that stunning Eagle lightweight GT E-Type that you wrote about on Drive Nation last week.
Yeah.
I mean, it just, even the way it looks, it's so gorgeous.
And those guys, I mean, they do. I mean, the car, it costs all the money, 800 grand. But, you know, these guys, they do four of those a year. And you know, they have separate cars. So they have a Speedster, they have a Low Dragon, they have a Spider GT, and now they've got the lightweight GT. And of all those cars together, they will make just four cars. So there may be an entire year where they don't make a lightweight GT because they, you know, they've got orders for other things. That's how few cars they make. And the craftsmanship is, I mean, it just kind of makes you proud to be British. It's just extraordinary. And the way they get them to look, I mean, an E-Type is such a complex shape. It's such a shape of utter genius that you mess with it at your peril. And yet there's not a single panel, not a single shape on it that is in common with any other E-Type. And you look at it on the road and you just think, it was born to look that way. And then you get in it and you just... the engine, the damping, they've, you know, the way that they have resolved the chassis, the amount of thought that's gone into it, it's an absolutely exquisite thing. And also, you know, and you'll know this with your A110, getting in the cars that are light and narrow, they just get down British roads better than cars that are heavy and fat. And yeah, I mean, I wasn't in it for that long. I probably only had a couple of hours in it, but I was on really, really good roads for that sort of car. And it was just mega. And, you know, and Henry Pearman and his team at Eagle have been making, they've been restoring E-Types and selling original E-Types. I think they've been doing it for 35 years or so. And I've driven everything they've produced, and this is undoubtedly the best thing they've done so far. And frankly, who knows how they're going to top it.
So you'll be selling your house to buy one, will you?
If only that would buy one, yeah. I couldn't even look at it. But I mean, I, you know, yeah, it's like all these things, you just have to be, you feel lucky that you got to drive it at all.
Yeah, yeah. It got a huge response, that post.
Did
I think people really loved it. Okay, well, before we end this podcast, I just want to mention one other post that you wrote, which was about Bruntingthorpe, which will mean nothing to lots of people, but to you,
dear
and I,
old Brunters.
Yeah, it means a great deal. So it's, I think it was an old Cold War airfield.
It was
in Leicestershire. It's a long one, close to 2 miles. I think 1.8 miles or something. But for the last however many years, a few decades, car magazines have been going there to test cars, to photograph cars, to more or less just knob around in cars.
Yes.
And I've had a good 10 and a bit years messing around up there. But it's now closing to the likes of us, because one of the other things that they do up at Bruntingthorpe is store unsold, newly built cars. And there's a
apparently
huge amount
quite,
of money.
Yeah, apparently there's quite a few of those knocking about at the moment.
Yeah, and so having a bunch of idiots driving around trying to practice their oversteer, that doesn't earn anything like as much money as storing thousands upon thousands of new cars. So that's what it's going to be doing from now on, which is such a pity. It is the place where I learnt to power slide a car. It's the place where I first did 200 miles an hour in a car, indicated at least, in a set of tuned 700 horsepower 911 turbo.
Yeah, fantastic.
It's just got an amazing history. Such cool things have happened there. Partly, or, you know, a good chunk of the cool things that have happened there are down to one bloke, Rob Wilson, who is driver coach to the stars, really. And he's sort of renowned for being there with a load of little cones set up around the airfield, and he'll use just hire cars that he'll return at the end of the day, and it'll be something very, very boring, like a Vauxhall Astra.
Astra's usually what he's in, yeah.
Exactly. But at any one point over the last couple of decades, Rob Wilson has had most of the Formula One grid with him up there at Bruntingthorpe. I know that he's had Kimi Raikkonen up there, for instance. I think he's had Danny Ric up there. You know, lots of them have spent a day with him in a Vauxhall Astra driving around cones, just learning his craft. One of the sort of distinctive things about him and about that place is that at the start of the day, everybody has to go up to the canteen and watch him eat a greasy fry up. And I know that one of the guys who's had to do that was Valentino Rossi. So no matter how many MotoGP titles you have, you get to sit there and watch Rob Wilson eat a greasy fry up, and you have to stop every minute so he can have a tab. I just hope that he finds a way to carry on doing what he does somewhere else, because, oh, it's just cool, isn't it?
It is cool, yeah. I mean, yeah. I could talk a bit about Rob, but I do remember just being, I was somewhere at Goodwood. He'd just won a race and had an amazing battle with Frank Sittner. This was a Goodwood revival years and years and years and years, and years ago. And I just happened to be there when Sittner came up to him after the race and went, Rob, I just don't understand. I tried as hard as I possibly could and I just couldn't keep up with you. That was an amazing drive. And Rob just turning around to him and said, the difference between you and me is you spend your time going sideways, I spend my time going forwards. And there is so much to learn about the art of going fast just in that comment alone. And yeah. You know, Frank was, you could just see him. He was absolutely on it. He was, you know, sideways here, there, and Rob looked like he was going to the shop. But, you know, anyway, yeah. And Bruntingthorpe, yeah, I mean, I think we've all had some great times there. What I loved about the place, it was just like the Wild West, wasn't it? I mean, once you'd sort of gone in there to LA, you could go and do what you liked, and they just treated you like grown-ups. And, you know, we've all sat there and thought how easy it would be to bury a car in a 747 or, you know, take out half of JLR's unsold car stock. But I never actually saw anything horrendous happen because, you know, none of us wants to have a big accident. And people who go there are known to the people at Bruntingthorpe, and we're not total idiots. We're almost total idiots. But, you know, we went there and we had so much fun. And in these massively regulated days where, you know, you can't do anything without, you know, risk assessments and this, that and the other, just to be able to go to a place like that where you've got a 10,000 foot runway, you know, and there are sort of V-bombers littered around the place, and just be able to get whatever you like, go there, do a 200 miles an hour, go sideways as you like. You know, I think that in 10 years time, if we're still doing this and we look back, we'll just think that we didn't realize how lucky we were that there was somewhere we could go, you know, this enormous playground where the likes of you and me could just go and cock about and be really, really silly. And no one's saying you can't do that. So yeah, I'll miss it. I really will.
Oh, we're going to miss it hugely, aren't we? Okay. God, again, I feel a little bit deflated after that. Anyway.
Sorry about that.
Well, let's wrap up that podcast then. Before we go, please do remember to check out our Patreon, patreon.com/drivenation, if you'd like to contribute just a little bit of money each month and help DN to grow and become bigger and better. A huge thank you once again to everybody who has
helped. Yeah, really, really thank you for that. Yeah, much appreciated by both of us.
It really does mean a lot. And last thing to say, please remember as ever to subscribe to the Drive Nation podcast, leave a review, leave a rating, all that stuff really does help. And Andrew and I will talk to you again the same time next week.
Look forward to it very much. All the best.
Bye everyone.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.